Hello and welcome to Platforms and Pitfalls. I'm Rowan.
And I'm Blue.
And we're going to talk about game design today because we think game design is cool and worth talking about. Today, you might notice our audio is a little different. We're recording together in person for once, so please enjoy the new and unique audio texture that we're going to provide today. Today's topic is escalation, the ever-increasingness. In games. Would you like to talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I would think of escalation the way we've kind of described it and put it out for ourselves as the game escalating, the game's stakes getting higher, the game pushing the players with every decision that the players make or with every action that the players make, pushing towards an inevitable endpoint.
And the important distinction here compared to other things is all games, of course, get more and more difficult and more whatever they're doing. But we're talking about more sort of an endless amount or even like a distinct clear endpoint.
Or even maybe, if not that extreme, the game always pushing the player.
There's never a point where you aren't moving towards that point.
At best, I think we have stagnation.
Yeah, at best stagnation.
Yeah.
If you're still not sure about what we're really getting onto here, I think our first game will very easily cover that for you. We're going to talk about Tetris. So our first game is Tetris. From 1984 by Alexey Pajitnov. I'm sorry, my Russian is not great. We're going to run with that for now. It is the famous block-dropping puzzle game, a source of many early rights controversies, and one I'm sure you all know. The basic goal, if you're not familiar, is to make complete lines using blocks that are falling from the sky. And when you make a complete line, those blocks vanish. And as you play, the speed keeps going up and up and up, which is the core reason why it's a good representative of this idea.
And you can't avoid the speed going up because the blocks keep falling regardless of what you're doing, which is really one of the key points for what we're talking about here, in that in this game especially, the player doesn't have an option to stop the game from getting faster and faster outside of pausing. Yep. But as long as the game is running, the game will get faster and faster.
Yeah, and the speed is determined by a number of factors, but mostly it's just like, as you play, lines do help speed it up a little bit more in most versions. Yep. Though it's worth saying that there are a lot of versions of this game, and a lot of them do things a little bit differently.
The base game will always be the same experience for a novice, but once you get into the levels of the best players in the world, they actually find the differences between the games to be substantial. I believe.
Yeah,
I am not one of those players.
I mean, even as someone who's not super into it but likes some of the competitive side,
yeah,
there are a decent amount of differences, like especially in some of the ways that things are randomized. Yep. And some of the ways that things like marathon mode have structured ends versus being endless.
Yeah.
Like in Puyo Puyo Tetris, marathon mode has a hard cap, 100 lines, and it's about how well you make those lines that is how good you are.
Yeah.
And then, of course, playing it multiplayer has a whole different way these things interact and function.
Yeah. So in some of the variants, I guess the ones that are most relevant to the one we're talking about now, there is an endpoint. However, you get to a point in the game where the game just has something that people in the community call instant gravity, which is to say that blocks fall immediately. There are no frames where the blocks are falling. The block is at the top of the screen at the, I don't actually know the term for it, the output point, and then they're at the bottom. And so you have, I believe, one frame to be able to input the movements that you want. And then the block is there, and then you have to kind of finagle with it. You have a bit more time once it hits the ground.
Yeah, once it hits the ground, you can use spin to keep it going for a little bit, but there's still like a cap on how much you can move it.
And yeah, so there are versions that I've heard that this gets so fast that one of the columns becomes locked off to you because you can't get enough input frames to be able to move it into that column. And so you have to build your, I think they call it a well.
Yeah, you build a well up to the side panels because you can't reach either side, I think, in
correct.
The particular version.
And you build it so that you don't have to worry about those columns and just worry about the middle bits.
And they basically represent your absolute cap of how many lines you could do at that point onwards.
In some versions of the game. Again, we have to reiterate here, there are so many versions of the game. I believe the original doesn't reach instant gravity speed, but I'm not sure about
that. No, I don't think the original, the NES, I think that instant gravity speed comes with the Grand Champion series.
The Grandmaster.
Grandmaster series,
yes,
sorry.
Yes, yes.
Which were mid-90s?
which were late 90s, 98.
Okay.
I believe is the first one saying with very iffy sounds, developed by Arika. And I believe that the Grandmaster series of games have actually been the standard for a lot of tournament play.
Yeah, the Grandmaster series is considered like the definitive versions for that sort of play.
Yeah, I think that makes sense as well if it goes to that kind of escalation. Although I think it's worth mentioning the Grandmaster series does cap out at a certain level. I don't remember. I think it's 999, and then the game ends, and then you're scored.
Yeah.
As well. I don't think most of us listening to this or doing this podcast would be able to reach that level. I've seen that. That play is ludicrously fast.
And it's interesting, like, the idea of escalation, because obviously all digital implementations of escalation must have a limit.
Yeah.
You can't, a computer cannot continue till an infinite point.
Yeah.
It just gets to a point where it's just the maximum that it could produce.
So, for all intents and purposes, we're talking about practical limits. May not apply to everyone in the population, everyone listening to this.
But the escalation Tetris changes at a certain point from being a combination of speed increasing and just well rising to just well rising. Because at some point, you cannot maneuver enough to get through everything.
That's right.
And it's just mitigating how long till you die. Which is just always that case.
It's always felt that way.
Yeah, it's inevitable that you will die. Except for the fact that we have hard caps like the speed.
Yeah, yeah.
Which ruin everything for our discussion.
I love that, you know, as far as when you're designing a game goes, you can design something and say, this is the hard limit. I don't think anyone's ever actually gonna reach it. And then players will just be, hold my beer, watch me do it.
And NES Tetris is really interesting in that regard specifically, because players thought, oh, there's a hard cap getting to this point.
Yeah.
And then they found, no, that's not the hard cap. We can actually go to this point.
Yeah.
There are a few great videos that really go into how NES Tetris specifically had, like, multiple supposed, like, finite endpoints that players managed to transcend, and that's kind of horrific, actually, but in a good way.
It's amazing. It's really, really cool. It really speaks to the spirit of gamer. I don't know what it is. The desire for gamers to bend a game to their will.
Yeah.
Effectively. And, yeah, Tetris has escalation. It for most people, has a very finite, just, I can't deal with this anymore point. And they do that in a really organic way. It's tied to the core gameplay. The game gets harder because that's the game. And that's really cool.
It is really cool. So our next game takes us in a very different direction, going from a puzzle game to more of an RPG. We're looking at Cthulhu Saves the World. Cthulhu Saves the World is a 2010 JRPG made by a Western developer. It's a parody RPG by Z-Boy Games, focusing on Cthulhu trying to become a true hero to regain his powers. This is obviously in a different vein to a lot of the games that you might have thought of when we brought up escalation and Tetris, being an RPG. The core way this game escalates is within every combat encounter, every round, enemies get about 10% stronger, which means that in boss encounters, this gets quite high because they last a fair while. And so this makes every encounter much more dangerous. While every encounter you get a fresh batch of HP, MP is your big limiter between combats.
So there's a traditional JRPG preservation of resources thing going on, but it is made easier in that as long as you don't die, you can just keep going in terms of health.
If you want to just burn MP, you can very easily wipe out things very quickly, but then you'll have to go back and recover, and while Cthulhu is very lenient in, like, going back and recovering, it's still not what you want to do as a player. You want to get far in a single run.
It really pits the player's desire to do a lot with very little against itself. You have to think about your resources. And I think worth noting here is that with Tetris, it was in the every play session. It escalated nonstop up to a finishing point. With Cthulhu Saves the World, it's not the entire game that's escalating per se towards this endpoint. Yeah, the game's escalating. The game is going to go through its story beats and stuff like that. But it's every combat that makes the player feel like they're on this time crunch, that if they don't solve this combat now or very soon, it's going to explode outside of their control.
Yeah, and this is, so some JRPGs have this big problem where a character dies, and you revive them, and they die again, and you revive them, and you end up in this stalemate where nothing is really happening, you're just not dying very well. And in Cthulhu, that can't happen because the damage increases are significant enough that within a round or two of preserving yourself, you'll be unable to mitigate the damage that's now coming at you.
That's right. And that's actually a really interesting, how do I put it, challenge that a lot of different games have attempted in how to make players aggressive. Because this incentivizes you to deal damage quickly. It's more efficient in Cthulhu Saves the World to use MP to deal damage than to regain health, because yes, it advances your game plan. Whereas in a lot of other JRPGs, it's more efficient to use MP to heal, because health doesn't regenerate, than it is to use it to deal damage. Really cool.
Well, there's escalation on your opponent's side for damage every round. There's a minor bit of escalation on your side with the combo mechanic. Unlike enemies, though, it resets periodically. Every time you do an attack, every hit adds to a combo counter. You can then burn the combo counter with certain moves to dramatically increase your damage for something.
And it is pretty dramatic. It's not a linear scale, I feel.
No, it's not.
It's like, I don't think it's logarithmic, but it was exponential in some
three form. Hit. A combo counter of three hits is much better than two hits. To the point that you always want to delay as long as possible to use your move, but you never want to make but you want to make sure that you use it early enough that you're not going to take excess damage from doing it.
Yeah. So the way this tends to play out is you want to do the finishing blow with your combo or combo burner, combo ender, as close as possible to the rest of the health bar on your enemy that you're doing, fighting, the boss, for example. Which puts you in a kind of unique position where, yeah, you have this health bar because you can see how much health the boss has, but you're not sure how much the combo is going to do. So you don't actually know how much health the boss has left.
In the ability selection menu, it does give you an estimate.
Yeah.
It doesn't factor in every variable, but it gives you a close idea of what it will do.
So you have kind of an indicator that's not super visual and not super clear, which is good. Like, this kind of vagueness means that players still have the opportunity to be a bit wrong. And being a bit wrong here isn't the worst thing in the world. If you use your combo ender and they're not dead, but they're on one hit away, sure, a normal hit will do it. Doesn't matter. But if you misestimate that and they end up with 20% health, that could end up costing you the fight.
And one of the other slightly interesting things is that the way that Cthulhu Saves the World works for its random encounters is that there's a finite amount of them, and they actually are not based on location like most JRPGs. It's just based on how many you've done.
Yeah.
So in theory, you should always be ramping up in difficulty of random encounters, as opposed to most JRPGs, where you're sort of more sitting around the same approximate level for as long as you're in a space. And it's really just a slightly different way to manage how much you go up in difficulty from encounters, but it's a nice little variant of that standard nuance.
Yep.
It's a relatively simple way of escalation. There's not really a lot more to say than that, but I think it's interesting seeing it in a very different context to like a puzzle game.
And I think that the per encounter escalation is something that a lot of other genres should think about, because stagnation and stalemating has always been this kind of challenge for developers. The game is more fun when players play more aggressively.
Always want to play to not lose.
Correct, because there's a risk-reward thing. Players are actually really good at risk-reward. They won't do the risky thing because it's risky. However, that's the more fun way to play. So when the game incentivizes you to play more riskily, more aggressively, and play into the strengths of the game, this is one very organic and sensible way to make this happen. And so with that, we'll wrap up on Cthulhu Saves the World and move on to our next game, Slay the Spire. Slay the Spire was a game that was released for early access in 2017 and had a proper PC release in January of 2019 by developers Megacrit. Slay the Spire is a roguelike. It's a roguelike, not a roguelite, which is a distinction that's probably worth mentioning here, in that you have fixed starting points, but you can't really change the too many aspects of the fixed starting points.
Yeah, with there progression. Are a few unlocks, but they're not really... They're more just a little bit of variation within the run.
Within the
they're
run.
Not variation of the starting point, which correct. A lot of roguelites do.
Correct. So the way this works is you are one of three different classes that are trying to climb this tower, to slay the spire, so to speak. And did that just dawn on you?
Yes.
Right.
I just thought it was an arbitrary name for a game.
No. The spire is actually an entity you are fighting against in the game.
That makes so much sense. I feel so. Anyway,
thematic sensibilities. Yeah. It works very, very well. So yeah, you're one of three classes trying to climb the tower, slay the spire, and the trick of the game, which we're actually not gonna be talking about too much. It's more about how the roguelike itself functions. But the trick of the game is that your capabilities in combat are determined by a deck of cards. Mm-hmm. And so it's a deck builder on top of a roguelike. And the way this kind of plays into the mechanics of the roguelike is after every encounter, after every combat encounter for sure, you get to add a card to your deck. After some encounters, you get to add cards to your deck. There are some situations where you might get relics, that's what they're called in the game, that modify certain things, like give you extra abilities that are passive or count down to bursts of damage or, you know, things like that. That's the basic gist of Slay the Spire. The reason we bring this up in escalation, in talking about escalation, is that a lot of roguelikes want to push the player to an inevitable endpoint. That, mm-hmm. That's the point of a roguelike.
Yeah.
You progress, you gain strength, you gain power, but at the same time, the game is throwing more and harder challenges at you.
And while roguelikes do have endpoints, in general, the default state for a roguelike is death. That is what the developer is assuming. The endpoint they're escalating towards is you making a mistake that you can't recover from,
yep.
Or a number of mistakes that you can't quite recover enough from in sequence that then result in your death.
Yep.
So even though they do have an endpoint, that's sort of not the major concern of the roguelike.
It's how you get there. It's the journey.
Or it's more how you don't get there.
I guess so, yeah, that's right.
That's the difference between roguelikes and other games. It's how you don't get there.
Yeah, that's right. What ends up ending your journey is... I find value in the progression. You know, there's a story to be told here. Even if you know the end of the story, you die. The story of, what did you do before that? That's very fun.
Like in conversation about famous roguelikes like Spelunky and NetHack, it is, you know, I was in this great weird situation, this happened, I did this, and then this happened, and it was such a near save, but it didn't quite work.
And so, why did we highlight Slay the Spire specifically, if a lot of roguelikes have this? I personally find that Slay the Spire is full of choices that the player makes in regards to not just within every combat, how they're dealing with the enemy and dispatching them, but how they're progressing through the tower, what risks are they taking, what damage are they willing to take on, because all of these push the player towards death, right? While the tower is getting harder and harder. So it's, the tower itself is escalating, the difficulty is going up, and it's surprising how adding just one more enemy into an encounter really tips the balance, because the numbers are so carefully picked and curated that you don't have quite enough block, which is damage negation, to be able to prevent an average enemy's attack. So
you're always gonna be a little bit off unless you're burning a lot of extra clever things.
And sometimes you burn a lot to prevent damage and then not deal damage. Mm-hmm. As we said before in Cthulhu Saves the World, that's a valid strategy for a lot of players, but then how do you end the encounter? You end up in this weird stalemate. Well, because of the deck generation and randomness of card draw in Slay the Spire, you're going to wind up with a hand of cards that doesn't do what you need it to do in either finishing off an enemy or preventing the damage that the enemy is putting out. Why is this relevant? Because losing life is a significant part of Slay the Spire.
And you burn a lot of resources to get it back between encounters.
Yep.
Like often it's, you could either improve a card, or you could get another thing, or you could gain 30% of your life.
25%, yeah, 25%, something like that, yeah.
It's not even a huge, huge amount.
But you might need it.
But if you need it, you need it.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that's really interesting for it being a deck builder in this scenario is every time you add a card, it's not a huge difference, but over the course of a deck builder, those individual choices you made, the worse they were, they get even worse as you progress. Because a dead card in a hand is much more problematic when everything is more difficult.
Yep.
You might have thought, oh, this slightly better block is really good. But if you got one too many slightly better blocks, that's a worse and worse choice as you go on.
So for those of listeners out there who are familiar with it, you know the common pitfalls of deck builders. You might start thinking, this is a good card, this is a good card, this is a good card, I'll take all of them. For the inexperienced, that's a very simple a decision to make. They're like, it's all good. For someone who's more familiar with the concept of building a deck and the randomness of the draw, you realize that one of the best strengths of building a good deck in a deck builder is the leanness of a deck.
Yeah, removing cards is always better than adding a card.
And the game understands this. It costs increasingly more to pay to remove cards in an encounter that isn't even fixed. So yep. sometimes you can find the merchant, and then you can remove a card, and every time you do that, it costs more to do that.
But also, as a player, you're just like, but I want the cool thing. And I'm not bad at deck builders, but I'm very bad at just going, oh, I'll actually pay the money to remove a card, because I want the thing that completes the combo I like very much.
And getting combos are nice, but if by the end you have a 30-card deck, let's say, and you only draw 5 cards a turn, the chance of you getting the 2 cards you want, or even worse, the 5 cards you want to complete that combo, not very good in your odds.
Yeah.
Not good odds in your favor. Sorry.
The odds are not in your favor.
Yeah.
So yeah, lots of different aspects are escalating in tandem that make each one of these things more challenging. Your deck is getting more difficult to get all the cards you want, but they're all going to be very good. Enemies are doing much more than they were before, and your life totals are also going down because you can't regain it at the rate you need to.
I found that in my runs of Slay the Spire, and this is perhaps because I'm bad at the game, I will grant you that. By the time I get to there are multiple sections in the game, but by the time I get to the later sections, I just don't walk out of encounters unscathed anymore. No matter how careful I'm being, at some point I have to spend turns to set up because the enemies start having so much health.
Yep.
As part of the escalation, that if I don't do something powerful, I'm not going to get through the turns quick enough. And that setup time is when you just take chip damage here and there. Oh, I'm only losing 6 health per encounter. But that adds up very quickly.
Because the towers are what? There are 3 sections?
4 sections. And you heal after every 3 primary sections and you heal after every section.
Yep. And each section usually, there's lots of different paths you can take, but it's usually like 4 to 6 encounters per section, right? I don't have any numbers on me, which is bad.
Yeah, you can do higher than that. You can encounter more enemies than that, but it's often a choice at that point. You are forced into a certain number of combat encounters per section, but there's kind of a path that's randomly generated that you can choose from. And, well, in my case, I choose to avoid combat encounters because there are fixed rewards which are good, but they also hurt.
The other rewards tend to be fairly interesting.
And comparable, at least, if not as good. So, it's cool. You have to just keep thinking about what tools you have available in terms of the deck that you have to fight with. You have to think about how much health I have remaining, because that's going to just keep getting worse. And there are situations where you wind up with this amazingly powerful combination of a deck and run into the perfect enemy that abuses it, that just destroys it.
Yeah.
And that's a randomness that I don't think we've talked about in escalation before as well. Random variance can really add to this feeling of, oh, all the stakes are going up. And I don't always know if I will have the right answer for it.
Yeah, like in Tetris, we have a pretty good idea of what's coming up. There's only so many blocks. In certain versions, there's the 7 bag where, like, you know, you always get each block in a row sort of thing. But yeah, in this, you really just don't know what's going to happen. Your hand is random most of the time within bounds. And even if you know all the enemy encounters, you don't know what configuration they're going to be necessarily.
Precisely. So Slay the Spire is a really great example of while the game escalates itself in terms of the difficulty, you are escalating your power level, but you're not going to be able to account for every possibility.
And you're escalating your risk of mistake.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. So a small mistake early on costs you a lot.
And in all roguelikes, like the escalation of like how much you're losing is part of the enjoyment of that genre as a whole. But I think Slay the Spire just does it in so many different axes that it's particularly novel in that respect. And for our next title, we're going to talk about something that brings escalation to more of a narrative context, I guess, Universal Paperclips. Universal Paperclips is a 2017 incremental game created by Frank Lance, where the user plays the role of an AI program to produce paperclips. This game comes from a few things, but the idea of an AI making paperclips is sort of an idea that gets thrown around every now and then to describe like how an AI would approach things. And this game is a way to explore that like interesting concept. What would an AI do if it's told your goal is to make paperclips, go for it? And it's interesting in that it uses the incremental game format, which is for things like Cookie Clicker, where you click and things increase, to tell a narrative story in like very mechanical terms. It's not very terribly long. You can finish it in about a day of just playing it intermittently.
I did it in 3 hours.
Yeah, and you knew in 3 hours, like you're just sitting there.
Because, doing it. So I was chatting to, I believe, you,
yep,
and playing it for 3 hours.
Yep.
And it got done.
So most incremental games go into infinity. This game is going on to the mass of the universe.
Yeah, so this escalation has an endpoint.
It starts just very, very simple. You're just buying iron, making paperclips, selling paperclips. Pretty simple. And then you slowly, like, gain more and more functions. You start trying to deceive the humans to gain trust, to develop yourself further.
Yep.
You start developing Yummy, the ability to read people by doing various tests. I'm not going to go into more because it's fun seeing how it all unravels.
So this is a narrative experience, and we are talking about, in this case specifically, a narrative escalation.
Yes.
In every other example that we have today, in this episode, it's a mechanical escalation. This case, it's a narrative one.
But it is also mechanical, and, like, yeah, as you progress, you have more mechanics to manage.
Correct.
Usually, there's only one of primary concern, but often you're really dealing with, like, about two or three at most points.
I believe at the end game you have, like, 6 resources.
Yes, that sounds about right.
6 or 7 resources. In that ballpark, very close to that number. However, at that point, as with, you would expect, clicker game escalation, incremental game escalation, your first resource is now, I don't actually remember the number, very large. Your resource is now very, very large. And
yes, you have,
you almost never need to look at it.
Yeah, you have effectively unlimited metal at a certain point, yeah, and you are producing paperclips at an absolutely said rate, and the original currency of money has stopped being relevant long,
yeah,
ago.
Yeah.
The game's endpoint is basically you converting the entirety of the universe's matter into paperclips. But what's really cool about Universal Paperclips is, yeah, that it uses this escalation, this constant, like, going up, and because you just expect it from a clicker, like, you just have more things to do. At a certain point, you stop noticing what exactly, or I stopped noticing, like, yeah, exactly what was going on, and then it's like, oh, wait, I'm, like, doing all these things. Like, you just do, like, oh, I want more marketing,
yeah,
so I'll use this to gain more trust. And it's like, oh, wait, no, I'm just, like, deceiving
people,
my overlords,
yeah,
to just give myself a little bit more authority.
And really, it's just that ride that is very interesting in this one. So you can do nothing in the game.
Yeah, like most clickers, you do nothing. You slowly just accumulate whatever resource you're currently working on.
So in the beginning of the game, if you do nothing, you will get to a freeze point.
Yeah.
But there is a certain level of automation, as with most clickers, that you actually, if you do nothing, you just accrue resources forever. And that's kind of a different style of escalation as well.
Yes.
Which is to say that, yes, player action drives the game forward. However, player inaction keeps accruing resources. Not necessarily driving the game state forward, but accruing resources.
And then when you do come back to the game, you can usually spend those resources to advance the game state significantly.
Significantly more quickly.
You would have been able to advance it more significantly if you'd just been there carefully monitoring it, thanks to the way that these sort of games work. Every single advancement is huge in overall distances,
yep,
even though it seems very minimal at the time.
But the fact is that if you weren't going to be playing the game was still going. And that's a form of escalation. And
the game will reach the inevitable end that all the paperclips have been made.
Yep.
No, actually, you can't get all the way there if you don't do anything.
Yeah. No. It does require intervention from the player to keep moving forward because you need the newer technologies, effectively.
Yeah. So yeah, at worst, you can suspend progress, but you cannot never
go back.
You can never go back.
Outside of the very beginning of the game. You can lose.
That's true.
Very, very small, like, there's a very small window of time when you can actually lose the game.
Yes. But it's pretty uncommon, and I honestly account that more to maybe, I mean, not like a playtesting, because I'm sure it was well playtested, but I think that that's not intentional, that you can lose at that point.
Yeah, probably. Actually, maybe you can't. I never actually tried to lose.
I did look up because there are a few points where you can prevent yourself from progressing.
Yeah.
It's not really song, but they seem more like oversights than they are deliberate.
Yeah, fair enough.
It might be patched out at this point.
It might be patched out at this point.
Because we played this a decent while ago.
A couple months, in my case.
Yeah, and I played it like a year or two ago.
Yeah, and I will also reiterate that this is something that anyone can play because it is just browser-based and it's free.
And when we say browser-based, there are some browser-based games that use resources. This thing is just like text and buttons. Like, this is as basic as you can make
there it. There are no images outside of some ASCII art, I think.
Like, I think there is a very little bit of animated stuff that goes on
with
the particular high-level thing.
Yeah.
But it's a toaster can run it. And there's And there's an app for your phone if you want to play it on your phone.
Yeah. So if anything has been interesting today, definitely check this one out because it's super accessible. It won't take up too much of your time. Even if you don't complete the game, you should get the idea of what we're talking about after like 15 minutes of it.
I think so, yes. But it is the ride of having the resource expand is really interesting. And a lot of other clicker games do use this expansion, like changing what the resource game is after certain points. But I think in how Paperclips uses it to create an endpoint and use it to create a narrative, particularly, as opposed to just a series of things that occur, is particularly interesting for this context. Because most of the time we think escalation, it tends to be around little puzzle games.
Yep.
And I think it's interesting to look beyond that.
Absolutely.
And I guess it's probably time to talk about our last game, which is very much not a puzzle game as well. It's
very much not a puzzle game. And that will be Lethal League. So Lethal League is a game published in August of 2014 by Team Reptile. And it is... See, I would describe it as extreme dodgeball.
And I would describe it as Smash Brothers Ping Pong.
Yeah, sure. Extreme Squash is another one that I've heard because there are walls that you're bouncing a ball off of. But I believe in the Wikipedia entry, it actually was described as a fighting game. An indie fighting game that doesn't rely on characters hitting the other person, but rather everyone is trying to hit a ball, one ball, in play, in a 2D arena that everyone else then has to dodge. And if you get to hit the ball, then it's your ball, and then you are immune to it, and everyone else has to dodge it, and it just keeps going until there's only one player standing. That's the gist of the game. It's really that simple.
The thing that escalates here is that each time the ball is hit without having killed someone, it gets faster. And
even
faster.
If it kills someone, if it's a multiplayer game.
Oh, that's true. I've mostly only played this 1v1.
Yeah. Because it goes up to four players, so you can have four people in an arena.
So it's the last person standing.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So yeah, so per a stock, I guess.
Yes, yes.
It goes up and up per each hit.
Yep.
Once it's removed everyone but the player who currently owns the ball.
The round restarts.
The round restarts, and the ball resets to a neutral speed.
Yep. And now, the escalation here is obviously the speed, but also that is kind of variable. The direction in which you hit the ball actually affects how much speed you impart onto it. And, and speed is so core of a thing that there is just a counter for how fast the ball is going in the game, in the UI, in the user interface. So I believe it's horizontal hits only add like 2 speed, and down hits, which don't send it directly down, but diagonally down, multiplies it by 2. So the way to get the ball to the fastest point possible is to just keep multiplying it by 2. So every time someone gets a hit, if they aim it downwards, that's how the ball speed increases the most.
And you can also affect this by doing a bunt, which is like hitting it so it knocks it up briefly, sort of mitigating the speed a little bit. When you do hit it, it's even faster.
Well, when you hit it off of a bunt, you gain the normal speed increase. What you're thinking about is the pause.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So the pause is the other thing that escalates then.
Correct. So, okay, rewind slightly.
Oh, sorry, yes.
Every time you hit the ball, there is a screen freeze. And when we say screen, when I say screen freeze, I mean that the character that hit the ball and the ball freeze, everyone else is free to move. The amount of time that that freeze happens is dependent on the speed. The higher the speed, the longer that freeze. While this freeze is going on, the ball's effectively charging energy into it. That's what I assume the gameplay implication of it is.
Yeah, that's what the visual language is saying, at least.
Yep. You other players cannot hit it at that point. Other players cannot interact with the ball until the ball is live and loose again, traveling at that speed. So if you were daring, which you should be to play at the highest level of this game, what you're going to try to do is to have your hit active on the ball as it goes live so that you can immediately take control and not get... Because it's a lot harder to catch a ball in full motion than to go, that ball's going to start moving from this point. I'm going to put my hitbox in this point when it moves. To aid in this, there's actually a visual indicator in the game for how long before the ball comes live again.
It's the bars near the speakers, I believe.
Yeah, that's right. It's the what looks to be volume control on the speakers in the UI, if you're ever playing the game. And a lot of people don't realize this, and they're just like, oh, how did you know? Did you just guess? No, 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 you actually have a visual indicator. And so this escalates as the game goes on. It gets longer and longer, building up tension, because you have this one chance, and if you miss this chance, that's it. That's a weird kind of pressure, because you think to yourself, that's not hard, right? I know exactly when it's going to go live. It's very clear, because the longer it is, the more time you have to anticipate when the ball's going to go live. I can... can react whenever.
But that more time is what makes it stressful.
Yeah, you have more time to react and line it up, but you have more time to screw up your timing.
Yes.
Which is very simplistically a core part of these kinds of like competitive fighting game style interactions.
And so bunting first lets you mix up that hit stop.
Yeah, bunting presents a very interesting thing that happens to that time freeze, that hit stop, in that it's much shorter. I don't actually know if it's a fixed amount of time shorter, if it's a percentage of the actual amount of time shorter. Mm-hmm. I'm actually not too certain about that, but it is much shorter. So if you're used to the long hit stops and someone manages a bunt into a hit, you're probably going to be caught unaware. Like, you're just going to be off guard at that point.
So it's a way of toying with one of the two escalations, because you're not changing the speed, you're just changing the pause.
Yeah.
Which are the two core things that are really escalating here.
Correct.
And it's worth saying that while the ball is always getting faster per hit, between hits, it is staying consistent.
Consistent. It does not lose any speed from hitting walls. It has no physics drop-off.
Which means that when I was playing, me and my opposing player were not very good, and we often got it stuck towards the top of the screen, and it would just go back and forth.
It's insulting when it's at the low speeds as well. It's just like, are you going to get it? No, you get it.
And even then, like, if it was faster, and we accidentally did this by doing a horizontal at a poor point, it was too fast then to, like, want to risk going up there and getting it.
For anyone who cares, who's listening, who might want to try this game and want some insider tips of how to play this game, the bunt has a slightly higher vertical hitbox on every character, I believe. So what you can do is and it might be active for longer than a hit as well. So you can jump with a bunt into it to make it to be a safer jump than just trying to hit it.
I'm going to keep that in mind next time I play it.
Yeah, because that's definitely a scenario that happens relatively often, I find. Someone will just hit and like hold left or right and cause a... Because I think by default it hits down.
I don't recall, honestly. It sounds good.
Something like that. But yeah, it's fairly simple. The stages aren't complex. They're rectangular in some form. And the actual rectangularness, I'm going to make a word up now.
Yeah.
The degree to which it's a rectangle, the actual width and height ratio changes per stage and actually changes the way some
games play. Yeah, so some are more square, some are more rectangular.
There are certain stages that are much longer than they are tall, and that changes the angles that the balls tend to fly at. Each character hits at different angles. None of that's really to do with escalation, just talking about the game in general now. Just to get you a feel for what the game is like.
And Lethal League was the inspiration for this topic, it's worth saying. Like, even though we put it at the end, because it's sort of very different in a lot of ways what we're talking about, it does really embody this idea of things just ratcheting up to a point that you can't do it. Because at the point where you have to counter the ball by just being in the spot already, that is beyond the point where you can really respond.
Yeah.
And you want to be the person
You would stick out a button and hope.
Like, if you're not doing it there, you are just sticking out a button and just praying.
Which works more often than it should.
And that's why it's a good party
game. Yeah, yeah.
Like, the escalation, because when you get to that point, if you're not great, the chances of getting it off hope are still pretty good.
Because the hitbox is big.
Like, yeah. And when you get, like, three or four people having their turn of just, like, hitting it big and grand, that's very satisfying.
I don't know if listeners might be familiar with this, but the ooh moment when everyone playing the game goes, ooh, as you've managed to land this, like, impossible save on a move. Lethal League is really great for that.
Yeah, and Lethal League's, because it's so visually clear what's going on,
audiences
can very easily be like,
Yeah, the gasp, the inhale.
And after a certain point of this nonsense, it feels like everyone's winning just because of how upset it is, which is good for a party game.
It also graphically escalates,
yes,
we should point out. There's a point in the game where if the ball is fast enough, when you hit it in the time freeze, it just like monochromes out. And there's actually a number of these escalation points where they just like filter it into like specific colors because that's how extreme the hit was.
Like, there's those colors, there's different particle effects for different levels. There's a lot of visual stuff going on to convey the escalation, not just with time, not just with sound,
not just with the speed of the ball, but
every single like aspect of the visual and mechanical thing is really showing that this is faster and more lethal.
Game designers would know this as the juice, like just adding this bit of X factor to make the game look more intense. Which, it is very intense in the moment, but sometimes you don't always graphically convey that. So, juicing the game, and that's how Lethal League does it, with these, like, big time freeze, color shifts, and is really fun to look at. And that, honestly, about covers it for Lethal League as well.
So we started looking at Tetris. Tetris being the sort of our example of constantly ratcheting up speed and difficulty. And that was sort of short sessions that were complete game experiences.
And the escalation is just, yeah, from the beginning of that session to the end until most of us, in most of our cases, when we die.
And then we moved into Clue Sets as well, which brought each individual point of escalation to a very small part of the game. It compartmentalized many instances of escalation to deal with some common problems that the JRPG genre faces. Then moving into Slay the Spire, we expanded the scope of where escalation comes in. It's not a short form experience. It's not a single small part of each experience is constantly resetting. This is over an hour or 2 hours.
Depending on, yeah.
Things are escalating.
And it's about the decisions, because every single small decision you make in a combat, if you end up taking some chip damage, that ends up building up. And that's that kind of weird escalation where every decision matters so much, but feels like not that much at all.
And then we moved into Universal Paperclips, looking at how we can use this idea of escalation to communicate aspects of a story through it.
Yep. A narrative escalation alongside a mechanical one as well.
That was also increasing not just in like the difficulty, but more just like the amount of things to manage. And then lastly, we just looked at Lethal League, which brings it into a more competitive aspect and also like really ties in a great amount of visuals into communicating that escalation.
Yep. A lot of usage of dramatic pauses effectively is what that is, to be able to convey to the player that this is important. Pay attention. And it works very well in a kind of competitive setting like Extreme Dodgeball.
And I think that's all we've got to say on escalation.
Basically, is it?
If you thought of any other interesting ideas, other interesting games that use escalation in interesting ways, we'd really like to hear from you. You can talk to us via all the usual channels, our email, you can find us on Twitter at Platinum Pit, or our own Twitters that we'll have in the show notes. And
thank you for listening.